Today is Monday, March 13th. We're going to talk about respiratory anatomy today. Okay, so page 69 begins our respiratory anatomy information. So we're going to start our journey with the nose as our first respiratory structure. It's about the only external structure that we've got for this system. So what does the nose contribute to helping protect your respiratory system? How does it protect you?
Traps bacteria.
Cilia traps bacteria. Good.
Mucus.
What's that?
Mucus.
Yeah, good. Mucus is in there.
Worms.
Worms, yes. So we've got a great day to talk about the respiratory system because it's been cold yesterday and today. If you go outside and breathe on a really cold day, you feel that air burn down into your lungs. So one of the things about our nose is it's a protective structure for the rest of our respiratory system. It does serve several protective roles, and you guys have mentioned pretty much all of those. So starting with the outside, as air enters into the external nares, there are coarse hairs located there to help trap big stuff like debris that may be entering into your respiratory system. Once we travel inward to our curvy turbinates, then those turbinates are lined with moist mucous membrane. The air is slung through those turbinates just like turbines of a fan, and bacteria, viruses, and debris are stuck against the walls of the sticky mucous membrane. There are cilia in there that help to conduct that sticky mucus to the back of your throat, and their job is to make that stuff slide down the back of your throat where you swallow it or you cough it out. The goal is to move it down along your pharynx, and here it should continue going down to your esophagus. Do you know what the pH in your stomach is? Really low, yeah, really acid. So if there are bacteria or viruses present in that mucus, then most likely what's in your stomach in terms of acid will kill anything that comes along. So that is the benefit of having the cilia move that contaminated mucus to the back of your throat for you to swallow it. On a cold morning, though, those cilia are slow and they're less likely to propel that mucus to the back of your throat, and you're more likely to have the mucus drip out your nose. So that runny, clear, drippy nose that we have in the wintertime may only indicate that you've got sluggish cilia, not that you're sick. On a warm day, you quite likely have the cilia doing their jobs and moving that mucus to the back of the throat. There are blood vessels closely associated with this moist mucous membrane, which is good because they provide warmth to the air that's coming through the nose as well. So we've got coarse hairs, we've got sticky mucus, we've got cilia, and we've got the ability to warm up that air that comes through our nasal cavity. Likewise, on a really cold, dry day, since those blood vessels sit close to the surface, it's very easy for us to have a nosebleed thanks to the dry air that passes through those turbinates, those concave there in the nasal cavity. Okay, so we've also got a soft and a hard palate that separates our nasal cavity from the oral cavity. Which one of those is provided or supported by bone? Hard palate, good. What two bones make up your hard palate? Palatine and
maxillary.
Yes, certainly maxilla bones and palatine bones make up that hard palate. The soft palate is supported by no bone, and that's why it's called soft. Its job is to help make sure that that mucus that drips off the back here slides down the throat. And so if you happen to cough, that uvula that hangs back there at the back of your soft palate should seal up the top part of your nasopharynx and prevent whatever's being coughed from going up into your nasal cavity. I know we've all coughed up stuff and had stuff come out your nose. It's really a disgusting thought. But when that happens, that uvula was not able to properly close off the opening to your nasal cavity. But that's its main job, is to seal up that area back there. Okay, so we've got our physiology down pat. We've got filtration, warming the air, humidifying the air, and then smell, of course, is a function of our nasal cavity as well. Thinking back to Bio-210, which cranial nerves pick up on odors?
Olfactory,
good. Cranial nerves, called the olfactory nerves, pick up on that smell information. So there are some hollow bones scattered around your face. These are called sinuses. In this picture, you can see two of them. This is our frontal sinus and your sphenoid sinus back here. But in this picture, you can actually get a feel for the rest of those sinuses. These sinuses make mucus. That mucus drains into your nasal cavity through tiny ducts. And so there's where a lot of the mucus comes from in our nasal cavity. If you have a sinus infection, you may have inflammation of the mucous membrane in there, or you may in fact have an infection of that mucous membrane. So when that happens, we oftentimes have pressure in our head or a sinus headache, and it may not be just the frontal or the maxillary sinuses. It may be back behind the eyes in the ethmoid or even in the sphenoid sinus. So that pressure is back behind your eyes, back further in your head. In addition to producing mucus, what else do our sinuses do for us? How heavy is your head? Heavy, yeah. 8 to 13 pounds is on average the weight of a human head. And so these sinuses are like air pockets that lighten your skull. So in fact, these are airhead pockets, right? They help make your head a little more lightweight, a little more buoyant, but they also provide a resonance chamber for speech. And you know this because every time you've had a head cold, you can hear your own voice echoing inside your head. So that hollow pocket of air inside these bones that create sinuses also give you a place where you can hear your own voice echo. I think most of us hate to hear ourselves on a recording. You know, you sound funny. You sound different than you do to everybody else. But nonetheless, that process of echoing through your head is what happens there in those sinuses as well. So let's turn our attention toward the throat region. The throat is also known as what? Pharynx, good. Now, from superior to inferior, can you tell me the three subpharynx regions?
Naso, oro, and laryngeal.
Good. Naso, oro, and laryngeal, or laryngo, and those go from the superior portion above your soft palate all the way down to the area where your larynx is situated. So we've got three main regions here. Let's talk first about that nasopharynx region. This is a rather busy picture, but let's locate our nasopharynx right up here. The way to locate it is to look above your soft palate. And what are some features you commonly find here? Well, we've got an opening to the eustachian tube or auditory tube. Why is that an important opening? Yeah, it drains your ear, right? That auditory tube opening that comes in right here connects to your middle ear. It also opens up and gives equalization of pressure to either side of your eardrum or tympanic membrane. Now, we need that auditory tube opening there because it helps us to keep pressure out of our ear. If you happen to have, say, a trip into the mountains or an airplane, we know that pressure builds on the outside of our tympanic membrane, and yawning or pulling on our earlobes helps to open up that tympanic tube on the other side. So that equalizes ear pressure. It's also a great place for bacteria and viruses to work their way up into the inner or middle ear and cause an ear infection. So that's an unfortunate thing about the way that tube is set up. What else is in the nasopharynx region? Any tonsils? What type of tonsils are in the nasopharynx? Actually, it's pharyngeal. Yeah, and they're the adenoids. And in fact, it's not two sets of tissue, it's just one big mass. So the adenoids are the other name for the pharyngeal tonsil. It is found up above your soft palate. You can't see this one by yourself. Someone would have to look through your nose with one of those lighted scopes to be able to see your adenoids. But, you know, there's something that you can't see by yourself looking into your mouth or your nose at home. When tonsils are removed, maybe perhaps due to repeated infections, they take out those pharyngeal tonsils, sometimes called adenoids, in a surgery they call tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy, a TNA surgery. Okay, so that's the nasopharynx. Especially if it's blocking the air passageway, it's okay to have them taken out. I guess the disadvantage is nowadays we know how important they are in filtering bacteria that comes into your air and food that comes in your mouth and nose. But I guess they weigh the pros versus the cons of, is the repeated infection worth the value that the tonsils add?
But yeah, if they're swelling to the point that they block off that air passageway, that's probably the deciding factor for saying they should go. All right, looks like we're down to the bottom of 69. How about questions on that page? So what types of things do we find in our oropharynx? What kind of tonsils? Palatine, good. Lingual. So we got four tonsils now in the oropharynx region. And their job is to filter incoming bacteria and viruses and the air and food that we take in. So the palatines are the ones that you can see by saying ah on either side of the back of your throat. The linguals are much harder to see. They're at the very base of your tongue. But both are situated in that oropharynx region. Come on down a little further and you've now entered the laryngopharynx. This is a place in your throat where we now have to decide, is it air and it's going to travel into the trachea, or is it food or water and should it travel back here into the esophagus? So at that point, the laryngopharynx is becoming the time where we have to decide how to route this stuff further. So in terms of the respiratory system, this pharynx region is basically a passageway for both food and air. And then we get down to where we have to make a decision and split that air into the trachea or food into the posterior esophagus. Let's take the anterior passageway, known as the larynx. What's a common name for the larynx? Voice box, good. So common name is, of course, voice box. This is an organ, okay? When you've talked about organs in the past, we know that organs are made up of two or more tissues working to solve a common function. There's a lot of tissues here, starting off with this one. This is your hyoid bone. And the piece of tissue sticking up above is an elastic cartilage flap known as what?
Epiglottis.
Good. As we come down the front side, we notice a really large shield-shaped piece of cartilage. This one is known as?
Thyroid
cartilage. Good. And below that?
Cricoid
cartilage. Good. And they've actually linked in a piece of the trachea. These are the C rings of cartilage found around the trachea. From the side view, you get the epiglottis sticking up there. It is a flap of elastic cartilage. And inside, we get these vocal cords, which are nothing more than folds of mucous membrane. As we travel down further, you get a look at that thyroid cartilage, and then you get a look at all of those C rings of hyaline cartilage that make the trachea's opening. Once we get into the larynx, we're working with an open system here. This is a patent or an open airway. Why is it critical that this airway stands open? So you can breathe, yeah. If this airway collapses, you would spend all of your energy trying to force air in through a collapsed pipe, so that would eventually exhaust ourselves. So we have to have an open or a patent airway starting here with the larynx. Okay, so what is the function of the epiglottis? Good. Keep food from traveling down the airway. In this picture, the epiglottis is sitting right around here. You can tell it's somewhat of a flap. And on either side of the glottis, or the opening, you've got the vocal cords. Some textbooks say the glottis also includes the vocal cords that surround on either side, but we oftentimes simply say the glottis is just that opening between the two vocal cords. So, how do you produce speech? Vibrating, yeah. Vibrating those vocal cords as air passes through. So we do learn to control those vocal cords early on and how to produce speech. By themselves, vocal cords just make a humming noise. So in combination with how you move your teeth, your mouth, your tongue, your lips, all of that, that's how you actually get different sounds. So it's in combination with the humming, buzzing noise you hear with that vocal cord. Okay. I do want to mention something we've talked about before. We've talked about the vagal maneuver or Valsalva's maneuver in a previous chapter. What does that maneuver do to your heart rate?
Lowers.
Slows it down, right. So which nervous system division are we activating?
Parasympathetic,
good. And which cranial nerve?
Ten,
vagus nerve 10.
So if you close your vocal cords, you're going to trap the air in your thoracic cavity, in your lungs, and not allow it to leave. That activates your vagus nerve, and it promotes a process called the vagal maneuver, otherwise known as Valsalva's maneuver. So I did want to mention it once again. Here it is in your course pack. So Valsalva's maneuver involves the closure of your vocal cords. They close just like a sphincter and keep your vocal cords shut. So you may have recalled hearing about Joan Rivers passing away a couple of years ago, and she had undergone some exploratory surgery for her vocal cords. And what happened was they gave her medication to put her to sleep, and her vocal cords paralyzed and froze shut. And so when they closed shut, she was no longer able to breathe. Had they caught that when she was still in that surgery process, they might have been able to administer a tracheotomy and bypass those spasm-shut vocal cords. So that's why there was a lot of lawsuit and turmoil after her death. Her family thought that that was a preventable death simply because those vocal cords could have been bypassed with a tracheotomy. So what would a tracheotomy have done for someone whose vocal cords have frozen shut? Open up the airway, right? So it bypasses that particular portion and gives you an airway down below. So yeah, in cases where those vocal cords are not able to open, whether it's, say, you know, medical induced through, say, drugs or a spasm of those vocal cords, a trach can insert an opening further down in that air passageway. Okay, so let's turn on over to page 71 and talk about the trachea. Like intubation, that doesn't necessarily give you a trach, but that just gives you an open airway in case those vocal cords would happen to snap shut. Yeah. Yeah, but that's not the same thing as like a trach or something.
So a trach, that would be under.
It'd be under, yeah. It'd be further south or inferior in that passageway. Let's see, the trachea is another open or patent airway. It's meant to keep the airway open so air can flow freely down into your lungs. This particular organ is a opening that has C rings of cartilage passing around the front and the sides. It is important to realize that these rings don't travel the back side of your trachea. What other tube sits on the back side or the posterior side of your trachea?
Esophagus.
Yeah, so what travels down your esophagus? Okay, and so if food is big, then you may have trouble getting it swallowed if you don't have room to expand in the back side of your trachea. So that's a benefit of having C rings and not O rings of cartilage to travel all the way around your trachea. It gives us some flexibility when we swallow large pieces of food. All right, so the trachea is about 4 inches long. It exits here at the base of your larynx. It travels into your thoracic cavity, and then it immediately splits into your two lungs. So the trachea is nothing more than a conducting passageway for our air to those lungs. If we look inside the trachea, what type of tissue forms the lining? Oh goodness, back to Bayer 210, right? Pseudostratified, yeah. And by the way, this is ciliated, and this cilia is pushing contaminated mucus up towards your mouth. Why shouldn't we push it down toward your lungs? Yeah, we don't want this stuff in our lungs. Whatever makes it this far in your respiratory passageway should be moved up to your mouth, where you either can cough it and get rid of it, or you can swallow it, and then of course it goes to your digestive system that way. So, interesting thing to note here, the mucus in your nasal cavity is moved back by cilia down to your throat so you can cough it or swallow it. But once you go into your trachea, from that point down, all those cilia are pushing contaminated mucus up to your mouth. So the goal is to prevent that contamination, whether it's bacteria or viruses, from making its way down into your lungs. So we know that cigarette smoke can burn off these cilia, and so that reduces our protective function of having that mucus moved up and out. So how do people who smoke get rid of their contaminated mucus? Cough it out. Yep, that cough reflex is the only way to get rid of that contaminated mucus. The good news is that once smoking is stopped, then that cilia can grow back and they can restart their process of moving that mucus up to your mouth to get rid of it.
All right. About halfway down page 71, we've got the bronchi. The first branch off of your trachea is called the primary bronchus. Keep in mind, a bronchus is a single branch. Bronchi is the plural form, both branches. And just to remind you from lab, that little space where the two bronchi come off is a V-shaped piece of cartilage known as what?
Carina.
Carina, right. We talk about that specifically because it's a great place for bacteria to hang out. Pneumococcus, that causes pneumonia, loves to hang out in that carina area. So we do mention it for that reason. What do you know about the size and shape of your right and left primary bronchus? Yeah, right one is wider. It's also shorter, and the left one is more narrow, but it's longer. So why is that an important difference to note? Right, your heart's making that difference in symmetry there, so of course the heart makes the right one wider and shorter. It's also critically important for things like aspiration of food or objects into the lungs. If you happen to inhale something, which side is it most likely going to be lodged in? The right side, yeah, because it's wider, there's more room for it. Every few years, there's a push among parent groups to reshape hot dogs. Why hot dogs? Perfect size, yeah. If you cut a hot dog into ring-like shapes, they are a perfect size and shape to get lodged in the right primary bronchus. Sometimes kids aspirate or suck in that piece of hot dog, and it lodges there just like a plug, and unfortunately, the only way to get that out is through a Heimlich maneuver. So that would have to use the air in the lungs to force out that piece of food that's stuck in that right primary bronchus. Wider and shorter, yep.
And that's
that is the primary bronchus. Peppermint candies, you know, the striped peppermint candies are also about the same size as a hot dog ring. So if you happen to suck on those, you'd have to be very careful because those too can be aspirated and sucked into that right primary bronchus. Any piece of food for that matter can get stuck in that right primary bronchus. So after the right primary bronchus, we then separate into, after the primary, we separate into smaller secondary bronchi. And from the secondary, we branch into even smaller tertiary bronchi. I do want to mention that once you start with your bronchi, you no longer have those C rings of cartilage. You don't have to deal with the esophagus anymore. Now you're dealing with O rings, rings that travel all the way around the entirety of those branching passageways. These passageways all have cilia. It is still their job to push that contaminated mucus up towards your mouth so you can swallow it or cough it. And so that cilia will eventually run out because we are going to get to such a small structure that we're no longer going to have room for them. Let me take you to the bottom of your page with bronchioles. Dylan.
Where did you say the O-rings start? Primary.
Yeah, start with the primary and they run to till you get to your bronchioles. So you can see the passageway here from the trachea to the primary, secondary bronchi, tertiary bronchi. There's actually several types of bronchioles. There's terminal and there's respiratory. We're not going to focus on the various types. We're just going to say there's bronchioles as the very smallest passageways. These bronchioles lead us into alveoli. Those are the air sacs that surround those bronchioles. And it's starting at these last sets of bronchioles and alveoli that we can now perform gas exchanges. Thinking back to our capillary structure, this was way back into our blood vessel chapter. What was the capillary structure like? Yeah, thin, one layer to the wall, okay? And so that made it very easy for us to do an exchange of fluids. That's the same concept here, because if we're going to do gas exchange in some of these bronchioles and these alveoli, we now need a setup that is about one layer thick. So once we get down to those last portions of bronchioles, we start getting into a very thin-walled structure. In fact, some of these respiratory bronchioles have no supporting cartilage to keep them open. Those passageways don't have room for cilia either, so we're very quickly getting to a passageway that is very small, very narrow, and has no defense mechanism in terms of cilia. Okay, bottom of your page there, notice the term respiratory tree. Okay, that's bottom of 71. This is now the time when we're starting to get into a region where gas exchanges can occur. And so the respiratory zone includes some of these bronchioles and, of course, those air sacs known as alveoli. The very last line down there mentions that since there are no cilia in these terminal or these respiratory bronchioles, we must use some other mechanism to protect us from bacteria, and that comes in the form of macrophages. So how do they protect us? Good, they eat. So they eat bacteria, viruses, whatever comes in contact with this region. So there is no room for cilia. There is hardly any room for cartilage to keep the passageways open. So macrophages do the job of keeping the place clean. Speaking of alveoli, let's flip the page to 72. Do you have questions so far? How would you describe what you see in terms of alveoli?
Grapes.
Yeah, a lot of people say grape clusters, yeah. These little clusters of air sacs surround our bronchioles. They are the sites of gas exchange in the lungs. Because they are so thin and so tiny, they have no room for any cilia. They too have macrophages. So those macrophages patrol, they clean up and eat bacteria and debris that get into this far reach of the lungs. They say that if you were to lay out your alveoli, that the surface area would equal a football field. That's a massive amount of surface area in each of our lungs. That really drives home the point at how efficient they are at doing the gas exchange process. Speaking of gas exchange, we know that pulmonary capillaries surround these alveoli. What blood gas is moved from your alveolus into a pulmonary capillary? Oxygen, good. So we're loading oxygen in for transport, and we're getting rid of what blood gas?
CO2,
good. So we get rid of or unload carbon dioxide. It moves from the capillary into the alveolus for export out of the system. So this exchange location in our alveoli is where we do this gas exchange, loading and unloading those blood gases. You'll notice on your sheet there the respiratory zone structures do include your alveoli and some of your bronchioles. You can actually perform some gas exchanges in those bronchioles since they are thin-walled enough for the process to occur. I do want to mention surfactant because that is what keeps our airways open. If you think about Pam cooking spray, why might you use cooking spray? Keep stuff from sticking, right. That is surfactant. Surfactant is your own Pam cooking spray. It's made by certain cells in your lungs. And just like cooking spray, it keeps your lung tissues from sticking together. Babies usually make this late on during their development. Usually by around week 38 or so, they've made surfactant. So when babies are born beyond week 38, their lungs will stay inflated. But if you have babies born prematurely before they make enough surfactant, what happens to their lung tissues? They stick together, they collapse, exactly. And so there's a fancy word for lung collapse. By the way, it's in your worksheet, but it's over on the next page. On the top of 73, you'll notice a term there called atelectasis. It's the third line down from the top. Atelectasis is lung collapse. Okay, so the lack of surfactant can in fact cause atelectasis.
Is that only in babies?
No, it can occur in adults too. Especially if like there's a punctured lung or something of that sort that changes the pressures in there, it can cause a lung collapse. Or if there's some reason that we don't make enough surfactant, that could do it too. So we've talked about the pathway into your lungs. We've actually traveled from your nose to the pharynx, to the larynx, to the trachea and the bronchi, down to the alveoli. So we did the pathway as air would flow into your lungs. What we want to do now is talk about your lungs, though, as organs. So in terms of organs, they are cone-shaped with the apex sitting right beneath your collarbone and the base sitting upon what muscle? Diaphragm, good. So these organs are meant to be elastic, they're meant to be stretchy, and they're meant to be able to recoil back to their original shape. There is no muscle tissue in your lungs, so we have to rely on the muscle tissue in your thoracic cavity between your ribs to actually power the air into your lungs and then move it back out. So the whole process of breathing relies on a healthy thoracic cage with healthy intercostal muscles between those ribs. You'll notice the left and right lung are slightly different in terms of structure. Which one has three lobes? Good. And the left lung has, of course, two lobes. Why the difference, once again? Because of the heart, yep. Okay, let's talk about the pleura coverings on the lungs. We've talked about the pericardial coverings. Now we've got the same type of concept here, but this time we call them pleura since they surround the lungs on the outside. So the one layer of your serous membrane closest to your lungs is called the visceral pleura. What is situated between the visceral and parietal pleura?
Serous fluid.
Serous fluid, good. What is the function of that fluid? Good. Reduce friction, lubricate around the lungs. And the outermost layer is the parietal pleura. It, in fact, is anchored to your thoracic cavity wall. So when your thoracic cavity wall moves, so does the parietal pleura, and so does the visceral pleura. Let me explain how these two layers are stuck together. If you've ever taken a glass, a drinking glass that's got cold water in it, and you sit it on a table and that glass sweats, you may come back 30 minutes or an hour later and try to pick that glass up off the table. Well, since it has sweated all the condensation to the table, you've now got a water seal that you have to break to pick it up. If you try to pull that glass straight off the table, you'll notice there's water suctioning it to the table, right? But if you kind of break your glass to the side and then pull it up sideways, you can get it to break free with no problem. That's the issue here between the visceral and the parietal pleura. Because the water, the serous fluid, is situated between those two layers, they are stuck together, literally sealed by that water attraction. So wherever the parietal pleura goes, so does the visceral pleura. That is part of the portion of inhalation that we're going to cover as we work through the physiology later on. So understanding that those two layers are sealed together by a water attraction is going to be important for understanding how we breathe. Speaking of muscles, at the very bottom of your page, the two main sets that we're going to pay attention to for breathing are your diaphragm and your intercostal muscles. So where do we find the diaphragm? Base of your lungs, good, up underneath your lungs. And the interesting thing is it's got both involuntary and voluntarily controlled muscle. You can breathe without thinking about it. Likewise, you can talk and control the contraction of the diaphragm. Where do we find the intercostal muscles? Good, between the ribs. So we've got external and internal that do opposite jobs between our ribs. So we'll tie in them to our conversation. Do you have questions so far on our respiratory anatomy? Nicole.
Can you explain that example of the glass?
The sign and sheet, okay. Yeah. If you take a glass and sit it on a table, you know how it will sweat and the table and the glass get sealed together by water? And if you try to pull the glass straight up, there's like a suction between the two. That's the same thing that happens between your visceral and parietal pleura. There's water stuck between the two, and if you try to pull one, the other one goes with it. They're literally stuck together by the water adhesion, that water attraction between those layers. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. Do you
y'all have other questions so far on any of this anatomy stuff? I'd like to take a detour for just a moment and talk with you about respiratory disorders on page 73. Since we just got through talking about pleura, then let's first talk about disorders that affect those pleura. So we've got pleurisy, pneumothorax, and pleural effusion that affect the pleura surrounding the lungs. Okay, and then we're going to talk about the types of disorders that affect the passageways, and probably the most important one here is COPD. Okay, so pleurisy is an inflammation of the pleura surrounding the lungs. When we're talking about inflammation, we're talking about layers or membranes that are now swollen, perhaps with excess fluid. And instead of gliding and sliding past one another like we would expect for them to do, the visceral and parietal pleura are now swollen and may be rubbing past one another. That rubbing process can cause pain when you breathe, and it can be associated with a lot of things, including cigarette smoking and pneumonia. So anything that causes an irritation to those pleura can cause pleurisy. And what you have to do is get rid of the root cause, whether it's smoking or getting rid of the pneumonia, that eventually will get rid of the pleurisy and that stabbing pain every time you breathe. Anybody ever had pleurisy? Pain? Yeah. So oftentimes, you know, it comes on the end of a cycle of pneumonia. People think they're getting rid of the pneumonia, and then it's just made the lungs a little bit too angry, and so they, of course, swell and rub. So it may take a long time to get rid of something like pleurisy. Pneumothorax is air pockets between the two layers. So this is a bubble of air between the visceral and parietal pleura. This pneumothorax can come from a number of different reasons. But nonetheless, you would have to extract that air. Otherwise, you could cause the lung to collapse, which we know is called atelectasis. Likewise, another similar situation is pleural effusion. This is not air between the two pleural membranes. This is some kind of fluid between the membranes. And yet again, this can put pressure on your lung and cause it to collapse as well. So there could be blood, pus, excess serous fluid that accumulates here. A number of reasons can cause fluids to develop between those two pleural membranes and cause that particular lung to collapse. So what do we do for a patient who's got fluid between the layers?
Aspirate.
You aspirate them, you have a chest tube. So pull out that fluid, whatever it is, into a bag, and then allow for that lung to re-expand to its normal space. All right. So let's talk about the passageway disorders. We're going to focus mainly on COPD and the disorders that lead to it. So in order to understand what COPD is, we need to differentiate between restrictive disorders and obstructive disorders. Restrictive disorders are ones where you cannot fully inhale air. Obstructive disorders are ones where you cannot fully exhale the air. And I keep that straight because obstructive means you can't get the air out. I keep the O's together. Obstructive and getting the air out is the trouble, okay? Restrictive is a difficulty getting the air to come into your lungs. So we're going to focus on COPD as an obstructive disorder. We're not going to talk much about the other three issues, cystic fibrosis, pulmonary fibrosis, or obesity, as they can cause other kinds of breathing problems. We're going to stick with that COPD issue. So COPD is a cocktail of diseases. One of the diseases that leads to COPD is emphysema. What is a leading cause of emphysema? Smoking, right. So what happens to those alveolar air sacs when someone smokes? A
they get irritated and they rupture. So what you look at here is normal alveoli contrasted with ruptured alveoli. So imagine having one of those wine festivals where they stomp the grapes. That's like stomped grapes. Those are all alveoli that have ruptured open. You lose surface area over which you can perform gas exchange. And that's no good because now you have trouble getting oxygen and CO2 exchanged into the bloodstream. So it's this loss of surface area that leads to the functional problem of emphysema. So I want you to notice what's happening with this person. See how he's sitting? Okay? Keep in mind this is an obstructive disorder. Is his trouble getting the air in or out? Getting it out. So you'll notice in this picture, these people are all sitting in the same position. They're sitting somewhat perched over their knees with their arms kind of away from their body. And I want you to look at the size of their chest. Not a muscular chest. This is muscle wasting. So notice his chest. Notice his. They are both experiencing a muscle wasting of the muscle tissue. So what are they working to do? Push the air out. Yeah, they are physically working to exhale. By the way, exhalation should require no ATP. And if you're having to force the air out, that can cause muscle wasting in your chest cavity. So they're called pink puffers for this reason. They're trying to push the air out of their lungs. They are pink and not blue because they're not having trouble getting the air in. It's getting their air back out of their lungs that they're having difficulty with. Keep in mind, emphysema is an obstructive disorder. Okay. So we know that smoking can cause many problems. Emphysema is one of them. Loss of efficiency, loss of elasticity. We know the tar can also build up in the lung tissue. Now, if you do stop smoking, that tar can be removed and the pink color to the lungs can be restored. So, you know, it's always a good time to stop smoking. There's always healthiness that can be restored back to your lungs to some degree. You can see a pink healthy lung on the left versus a smoker's lung on the right. Notice the black tar accumulations in the smoker's lung. And, you know, smoking can not only do damage inside but also outside. It causes tissue damage to our skin. These are twins. One of them smoked. Can you tell which one?
One on the right.
The one on the right, yeah. She was a smoker. Not quite as big a difference here, but can you tell the smoker in this picture?
Right.
Again on the right, yeah, two twins. Smoking is not the only thing that can cause problems with lung elasticity. People who work with welding and metal products like that can also get metal shards in their lungs, and that cannot be removed by simple exhalation. So in this picture of a welder's lung, these black spots in here contain some metal shards and metal fragments. So, you know, welding's a great career to have, but it's certainly something to consider when you think about your lung health, because it can cause things like, you know, metal accumulation and emphysema as well, pulmonary fibrosis. Let's see, COPD can include emphysema and asthma. So what is happening in the lung space during an asthma attack? Good, so what is constricting? Bronchioles, yeah, bronchioles constrict. So you'll notice that there may be excess mucus that gets into that space. The wall in there becomes inflamed, which constricts or restricts the airflow into the lungs. So in these cases here, we may see treatment using something like a corticosteroid that reduces inflammation, or even perhaps epinephrine. Why might epinephrine help somebody with an asthma attack? It dilates those breathing passageways, right? So what is the disadvantage of using epinephrine for asthma? Heart rate increases, good. So there's always a downside to that medication, right? What is the downside of using a corticosteroid like cortisol for an asthma patient? Cushing's disease, yes. Excess sugar transformation, so... Yeah, corticosteroids are great at reducing inflammation, but we have to be concerned with long-term problems like Cushing's. Okay, let's talk about bronchitis for just a moment. Bronchitis is an inflammation of the bronchial passageways. And in this case, you'll notice this man's chest is really bloated. This is a blue bloater compared to the pink puffer that we saw with emphysema. So this is a poor airway flow. Oftentimes these people can become hypoxic, and that's why we call them blue bloaters. So the cyanosis that we see, the blue tone to their skin, can also cause, you know, the loss of oxygen getting into their bodies. Okay, take a trip back with me to the previous chapter. If you have low levels of oxygen traveling through your bloodstream, what type of receptor picks up on that?
Chemoreceptors,
good. Chemoreceptors tell your brain that you've got low oxygen levels, and that turns on what type of stimulation? I about gave it to you, yes, sympathetic. Okay, and so what happens to your heart rate?
Speeds up.
Speeds up, good. Imagine this for years and years. That's how you get heart failure. So the lack of oxygen can make the heart rate speed up. The heart gets big and flabby. It loses efficiency as a pump. So there's where heart failure comes into play. This too is often caused by smoking. So the irritation to the lining in those bronchial passageways can then lead to this condition. When you're talking about COPD, you're talking about asthma, bronchitis, and emphysema. Those three are the trifecta that can form this particular disorder. We classify it as an obstructive disease because mostly we're having trouble getting the air out of the lungs and not into the lungs. Okay, and so once again, when you see COPD alveoli, they look like emphysema patients because they've lost their surface area and the gas exchange rate there is decreased because we've basically rupture those alveolar air sacs. Can you tell me which one of these pictures is COPD lungs? Actually, it's this one, top left. Yeah, see, there's not a whole lot of alveolar air sacs in here. So it just looks like a spider web that's been kind of torn apart. That's the loss of those alveolar air sacs in the top left picture. Okay. Do you have questions so far about our respiratory disorders? Okay, so what I'd like to do for just a few minutes is take you on over to page 74. At the top of your page, what we have is two pathways. The top one is going to be a guaranteed essay question for the test. That is the pathway of air into the lungs. That's the oxygen pathway. Let me help you fill in those blanks. As air travels into the nares and the nasal turbinates, it passes through one of the three throat regions. The first blank there is nasopharynx. We then travel to the oropharynx, and then where is next? Laryngopharynx, good. So that next blank is laryngopharynx.
So it just starts from the front?
Yeah, it starts from the nares.
I just want to make sure I'm spelling.
Yeah, and then the next one is nasopharynx, oropharynx, laryngopharynx. And then from the larynx to the trachea, we travel to the primary bronchi. All right, then we've got secondary, tertiary, and what's next?
Bronchioles.
From there, we travel into the alveoli. And if this is oxygen, it travels into the pulmonary capillaries, to the pulmonary venules, and then to the pulmonary veins. From the pulmonary veins, we travel back to the left atrium, good. And from there, we're back in blood flow through the bicuspid valve, left ventricle, aortic semilunar valve to the aorta. And now we're going out for systemic circulation to arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules, veins, SVC and IVC. And what's your last blank?
IVC.
good, right, Atrium? Those blank, sure. The very first one up there is nasopharynx. Then laryngopharynx. Then primary bronchi. Then bronchioles. Then pulmonary veins. Left atrium. Yeah, you got it. Aorta and right atrium. That's it. The pathway of CO2 back out is actually just a reverse process. If you search in your above tracing for the pulmonary capillaries, we're just going to go backwards from there. So from pulmonary capillaries, we would then go to the alveoli. And from the alveoli, we go to bronchioles. And I'm going to let you guys just write it on back out. Okay, so we're just going backwards, back out. You can put glottis, it's fine. All right, just checking to see if you had any questions about the reverse pathway of CO2 out. If you have a chance to read ahead for Wednesday, what we're going to talk about is breathing. And we're also going to talk about the control of respiration. That's a pretty thick topic, so if you have an opportunity to read ahead, either in your course pack or textbook, I think it'll be worth your while for Wednesday. Do y'all have any questions for today? Okay, I will see you on Wednesday.